And we are recording. So my name is Ruth Swanson. Today is November 9th, 2010, and I'm here with Sarah Timpson, who graduated the class of 67. So sort of on the far end of our oral history project. The first question we have for you is, how did you come to SAIS? You mentioned earlier that you had gone to Geneva to study to prepare yourself. What was SAIS's reputation and what drew you to it?
Well, I have to say, that in fact, it surprised me when you mentioned the history and that this was so early, because I had somehow thought that SAIS had existed for quite a long time. And
Well, at your age, SAIS was 20 years old.
Yeah.
That is forever.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I had considered was Fletcher or SAIS, mm-hmm. Because I had done my junior year abroad in Paris. Mm-hmm. So I already had that sort of international end of things. And I knew that was what I wanted to do with it. Then after I got graduated from undergraduate, I went and worked at the UN as a secretary. At that point, if you didn't have a graduate degree, you could not get, and I think that's probably mostly still true, you could not get a job at anything other than as a secretary, but I still thought that was interesting enough. And I, in fact, worked in the Secretary General's office, so that was all very exciting, etc. But then after a couple of years of that, I decided, hey, this is what I really would like to do with my life. And they encouraged me to do that, and I don't really know who it was who advised me on the potential places, but I knew that I didn't want to become an academic. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go to some place that, for better or worse, was known as a trade school. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what attracted me, particularly to SAIS, was its location in Washington and the fact that it was drawing on so many people who were actually in government and dealing with these questions on a day-to-day basis. So it wasn't just, you know, something theoretical, although there was a theoretical background that I managed to get, but it was sitting with people who, you know, would come in, and particularly not the full-time staff, but the staff who would come in once a week for a course, but who the rest of the time were working at the World Bank or, you know, in the Senate or whatever. And so that was what really attracted me to SAIS.
And you said you went and studied in Geneva. Was that your school when you studied abroad?
No, my junior abroad was in Paris. Mm-hmm. But then I went to Geneva because there was a School of International Studies there that I could just quickly. I think maybe I had already, because it was Aldi Chapin who was there at the time, and mm-hmm. I think maybe he was the one who advised me, okay, this is what you would need to do if you wanted to come to SAIS, because you do need some of the you need to have read some of the basic literature in this mm-hmm. area. So it was good to go to Geneva because it was getting my French up again. Mm-hmm. So, and between those two, worked well.
So what is your most, what memory stands out for you for your time at SAIS? What's your most vivid memory?
I know you have that in the questions. I was trying to think about what that might be, and probably, I guess the thing that had stuck with me most was we had one of the professors was Seth Tillman, mm-hmm. Who was working as a legislative assistant to Senator William Fulbright at the time. And it was at the time of the Vietnam War, 65 to
right.
67. And Fulbright was the arrogance of power days, and probably Tillman had a hand in writing the arrogance of power, et cetera, et cetera. And so although he was teaching a course in modern European history, he could relate all the things that had happened in the 19th century to and early 20th to what was going on in Vietnam and the mm-hmm. positions there. And so I think that was probably the most stimulating and most memorable course that I took. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he was able to do that relate the two back and forth. So it was a course that was packed.
And what's interesting is that describes a lot of what happens specifically in the strategic studies program these days.
Mm.
That they definitely look at the parallels between now and the past and bring lessons to bear on that study. You've had a very accomplished career working for the United Nations, and you were telling me earlier about being in, you said, the Philippines, Costa Rica, and Argentina. And you're now doing consulting work with evaluating grant programs, environmental grant programs.
Yeah, I'm doing various things. Mm-hmm. One is the UN gives out a prize called the Equator Initiative Prize, mm-hmm. which looks at, or the people who apply for the prize are communities who are doing something for conservation at the same time as they are trying to improve their livelihoods, and so how you can reconcile those two things. So it's a biennial prize, and we pick, there's a whole selection committee who picks the winners, first the pre-finalists and then the winners, mm-hmm. and so I chair that committee. Mm-hmm. And then I'm on another one which is called the Seed Prize, which looks at startup businesses which are environmentally sound and also community level. That one's sponsored by IUCN and the United Nations Environment Program. So again, I'm just on the jury of that one, but it's sort of similar stuff. So I do that in addition to these other consultancies that I've been doing.
Wonderful. What do you think historians would want to know about your career? What are the projects, the policies that you observed that you were part of that you think what people would want to know more about?
I'd say maybe three things. One is simply the evolution in the way I was thinking as I went to work on that. And it was an evolution in development thinking, too, I think. When we started out, when I started out, it was very much infrastructure, pre-feasibility studies for the World Bank to do, loans afterwards, and totally government-to-government operations. And as I did more of this, and as thinking also began to evolve, I got much more interested in the local level, community level, people's initiatives side of things. And that, I think particularly as I was working in Costa Rica and Central America, it was at a time of the Sandinistas, there was a lot of consciousness about people who saw that there were other ways of development, and that development, mm-hmm. As it was being conceived, actually didn't get down to the people who needed it most at the bottom of the pyramid. So I evolved in that direction. And so having been, I was also in Argentina at the time of the disappearances, so there you couldn't do much development work. What we actually ended up doing was using our program and our relations to the various UN system agencies to get people out and to other Latin American countries or to Europe as consultants or experts or whatever. But, I mean, they needed that as an excuse to be able to leave the country. And there were a lot because we had the program just prior to that had been when Perón had come back, and it started out being a relatively leftist government. Mm-hmm. And then when the military came in, it went completely in the other direction, and a number of these people started disappearing. And so it became an operation where you really couldn't talk about development at the time. It was a whole other system. And then I went back to headquarters. Oh, and the other thing I think is interesting is that at SAIS, I guess I had spent more of my time looking at African studies. And then, as all of these kinds of quirks of history, I ended up in Latin America. and having to learn Spanish, which I did at the UN. And then when I went to Philippines, it was also partly because Philippines has so much of the Spanish colonial mm-hmm. background, so and in fact was colonized by Mexico. Mm-hmm. So the Latin American side was very prevalent, but also there's the American, and then there's the Malay and Chinese and all of the mixture in Philippine society. So that was an interesting transition too. But I think one of the things I did was when we had an administrator who came in under the first Bush administration and who was a good friend and college buddy of Bush's. His name was William Draper III, venture capitalist from California. Knew nothing about the UN, but he's probably one of the more intuitive people, which is probably why he did so well as a venture capitalist. And he was particularly good in intuition about people. But he came in under this sort of Bush administration vision of the world, and decided that non-governmental organizations, women, and private sector were really what the UNDP should be doing. So those were his three kind of thrusts in the organization, which meant essentially he was talking about UNDP as being the other UN across the street. So it didn't get involved in all of this governmental stuff. It was going to work with the private sector and non-governmental organizations. And so that was, even although that was sort of on the right-hand side of the ideological agenda, in fact met the left-hand side, particularly the NGOs and the women in development side. So Bill asked me to head up the Women in Development Program, and I said, well, I really would be more interested in starting the non-governmental side. And so he said, okay. And so that I did that. It was at a time when people, and it was also development thinking was evolving, and it was a time when people were beginning to realize how much more important non-governmental organizations were doing. And there was Interaction, which was the American NGO coalition. Initially what people thought was, all right, UNDP is going to be contracting with all of these American NGOs to go out and do the things that they're doing. And what we said, no, because what our real purpose in UNDP is to build up the civil society of the developing countries. So we will try to work with them to the extent that they exist. Mm-hmm. And that was a challenge because so many of our people in country offices, we at the time recruited mostly economists and international affairs, etc. But the idea of working with NGOs, they would come back to us and say, well, you know, who are the NGOs in our country? We don't even know. We said, that's the point. You have to get out and find them. And we, in fact, provided some seed money to give small grants to NGOs. And initially, I think we started out in 20 countries, and it grew to about 40 countries. The ones that were interested, and where government would allow us to do this. Because we said we weren't going to run the programs unless we could decide that they didn't have to be vetted by the government, that the government didn't have to say, all right, we will work with this one and this one. So anyway, that's one thing of just getting the UNDP anyway to be working more through and to build up civil society in developing countries. I would say the other thing that was the most memorable is when I then went out to Philippines, and one of the reasons I went to Philippines was they had such a strong civil society. The NGOs had been responsible for throwing out Marcos, essentially, the NGOs and the students. And so they were very strong, and there was an excellent, really a real statesman as president at the time, Fidel Ramos, And so that's why I decided, okay, I'd like to go out there. And it was just at the time that they had signed a peace agreement with the Muslim rebels in southern Philippines. But nobody really knew how to deal with them because they had been in rebellion for 20 years and they had all of these military commanders who had divided up the areas among themselves and were responsible for the different areas. But nobody knew, all the donors wanted to come in now and help after the peace agreement, but they didn't know how to go about it. And the government said, okay, well, we'll do a study of what their needs are and we'll send in people from the university. And we said, well, they know what their needs are. Why do you have to send somebody from the university? They said, oh, but they'll lie. And we said, well, that's not really a very good way to start out in peace building. So we said, you know, we'll have somebody accompany all of these processes, but you know, let us try to do it. So then the problem was to go and convince the state commanders, who kept saying, well, where were you when we needed you? But after 2 days of talks, they finally said, trusted that we were serious, because we said, all right, we're going to let you manage this, but we want to start out in a pilot in one area. And they said, well, we can't, because we have 20 different areas, so we can't, just one is not going to respond to the needs. We have to have at least six. But we said, okay, we'll do six. And so they went out, consulted with their communities, came back with what their needs were, which were initially essentially food. And so we drew up the list, and we made the first delivery of the food items. And then they came back to us after that and said, well, we've realized this is just charity and this isn't going to help us at all in terms of where we want to go in the future. What we really need are small income generating projects. Well, we could have told them that in the beginning, right. But it was so much better that they went through that thought process themselves. And so then it was just at the time we were going through UN reform too, and so we were trying to work the whole system instead of our each individual agency. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we called it the multi-donor program, and there were a number of donors that were only going to give money if the UN was working together on this basis. I think Finland and Sweden and the Japanese who were the biggest donors in Philippines. Anyway, so they provided the funding for this, and if a community decided it wanted to do something in agriculture, we'd get FAO to come. If they wanted a health project, we'd get WHO to come in. So we got the whole UN system working on these different things. But the whole program was in fact run by Muslim former guerrillas, and there were some problems. Mm-hmm. But mostly they solved them, and one of the really positive things that we saw was the guy who was heading the program for us was, when there were elections subsequently, 2 or 3 years later, he ran for mayor from a city that was predominantly Catholic and won the election, which went to show that they had really managed to prove, at least to some people, that things were, that they were able to do things well. But the other thing that was interesting of it was that there were three groups of the rebels, and so the peace agreement had been with just one of the groups, and then there was a second one which was a little bit more fundamentalist, but not really. And they sort of said to the first, you know, we'll see what happens with you, and we'll come in if it mm-hmm. seems to work with you. And then there was a third group, which was the Abu Sayyaf, and they're the ones who we read about in the news. They're the ones that are still operating as terrorists. They're the ones that kidnapped the group that killed a couple of people several years ago, etc. And I had the two people who had played a key role in the whole peace negotiations. One was the Indonesian ambassador, and one was the Libyan ambassador, because a number of the Filipinos, the Muslims, had taken refuge in Libya for a while. So Libya was very much involved in this. And the guy who was the Libyan ambassador, he'd been to Georgetown. He was somebody who you could really talk to. And he was the one who advised me, said you can work with the two, the MILF and the MNLF, but don't touch Abu Sayyaf. And this was in 1997, mm-hmm. before we really knew a lot about this, but he knew, even then, and said, don't go near Abu Sayyaf. So that was, and it was only subsequently that we found out that the sister of the leader of Abu Sayyaf was married to bin Laden and
oh, <gosh.
laughs> Sarah. So, and that's why there was an attempted bombing in one of the Filipino aircraft, mm-hmm. and all that. So I guess those are probably the highlights, if you will. My last function was picking up on the earlier small grants program to civil society. Mm-hmm. We had, after the Earth Summit in 92, when the Global Environment Facility was set up, we had started Global Environment Facility Small Grants Program, mm-hmm. which would go to communities and civil society for environment conservation and development programs. And it was grants up to 50,000, but the average was about 20,000. And we started out in 40 countries on a totally decentralized basis, run by nationals of the country concerned. In each country, a national coordinator, and then you had a national selection committee. Because there was no way, by referring back to, you know, New York, that we were going to be able to say this is a good project, and mm-hmm. it's only the locals. So those committees were made up of a majority of NGOs, some academics, usually a couple, maybe maximum three government, but never a majority government. Mm-hmm. And they sort of had an informal veto if there was a group they really were not happy with. But that's why they were willing to let us go ahead with that. So after Philippines, I came back because I really liked that program. It was expanding, and I came back and managed that program for 4 years. And at the end of that period, we had expanded to, I think, 65 countries. More and more countries were beginning to see that, okay, this isn't a threat. it really is doing some good things for us. And now, it's still going on. It's now expanded to 110 countries, I think it is now. And it's getting, it's now up to, I think it's up to a $300 million program. So I think that's maybe the one thing of all the things I've done that I am the proudest of, was having started that whole initiative. So that's how it moved powerful. Into the whole, you know, community based. Mm-hmm. And SAIS, when I was there, didn't have its good old program.
Yeah.
But that was, I was going in that same direction, which was. Then it was incorporated in size also.
So. Yeah, I think you'd be thrilled with what students are studying now in the International Development Program. Mm. Our last question has to do with the conclusions you've come up with from your time and your career. What advice do you have for today's students?
Well, one of the things that I've been really interested to see is students these days have very little idea of going and doing what I did, which was having a whole career with one organization. Mm-hmm. They jump around and get all kinds of different experiences and are willing to take time off to do things. They're not so much concentrated on a career path. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it was also at the time when they were looking for women, mm-hmm. Because there just weren't that many women professionals around in this area. So, like when I was resident representative in Costa Rica, I was the only woman mm-hmm. among, I think there were 80 resident representatives in the world, and I was the only. I wasn't the first. There had been three before me, but I was the only one at the time. Mm-hmm. So I kept getting pushed into things, mm-hmm. And each one was more interesting and more challenging, and I never stayed in one job more than 3 or 4 4 years. So in a sense, I had that same change. But I think for students today, it's looking at what you really want out of these things. There's so many that go into government. I was just talking to a couple last night who go into government and get terribly frustrated. Mm-hmm. And the UN system is probably the same because you don't have too much room to exercise initiative and creativity. And in fact, I had a lot of friends in the NGO community who kept saying, "But why do you stick with the big bureaucracy?" And my own idea was, but because it's such a big bureaucracy, it is such an influential organization, if you can change the way it does business, then you're really having much more impact than you could have in a small NGO, maybe.
Well, and it sounds like in later years, when you're hitting up your own programs, that you did have an awful lot of opportunity to affect change.
Well, and in each case, I mean, another one was I ran something called the Prowess Project, which is the promotion of the role of women in water supply and sanitation, mm-hmm. and getting across to people the idea that all of these male engineers who were, you know, going in and installing water systems, but it never occurred to them that women are the managers of water at a community level. So mm-hmm. Either that didn't occur to them to talk to the women, or they weren't allowed to talk to the women. But in either case, it essentially meant that the large majority of these water systems were breaking down after a couple of years, and the community had to go back and start all over again, and then you get another donor coming in with another system. So it's these kinds of opportunities when you start seeing. The real problem here, and this is one of the things that I think we've gotten caught up in, maybe too much so, is as we look more at, okay, what is it about the private sector that works and the bottom line and results, this results-oriented framework. Unfortunately, in terms of the kinds of things we're doing, I see it much more as the venture capital, mm-hmm. that you don't know what the result is. I mean, you sort of know the direction that you want to go in, but you can't necessarily pick an indicator ahead of time, which is going to tell you that you're having the kind of impact that you would like. So we spend a lot of time, first of all, just on getting the documentation that you need to get out to donors and raise funds from donors, because the donors have to meet their own parliaments, requirements. And so the amount of time that goes into this documentation business. And in the UN system, for example, now we have the UN Development Assistance Framework, where all the agencies have to get together and work with government to put together, and it's a two-year process, etc. And now that so many governments are getting, you know, are more democratic and they're changing every 4 years. I mean, you get 2 years into the cycle and there's going to be a new government. And so, I mean, I really feel that spending that much time on those sorts of things is a real waste. Yeah. And that what you have to do, I've also learned that people make such a difference. And I think that, all right, you know more or less in terms of the UN system, Millennium Development Goals, whatever, what are the things that you want to support, but find the people in government who are trying to do that, and then support them with their programs. Don't go and sit back and design the ideal program, et cetera, et cetera. And then we come in and find out who is going to actually be hired to implement it. No, I mean, you have to do it with the people and use their own ideas and build on what they know. So I think that that's, I mean, I don't know what it is, the course content, and I'm sure that there's a lot of that sort of thing which is coming through now, but that's one of the things that for people who were going into international development work, I think that's one of the most important lessons that I would say, is try to move as far away as you can from over studying the issue. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, it would be one thing, it's the classic bridge, building a bridge. You know how to build a bridge. Mm-hmm. So you can put the blueprint and then you can follow the blueprint and then you know whether it's going to stand up or not. But we're working in something we still don't know what development really is.
And it's ever changing.
Well, that's it. It's not that it is changing, it's that we are realizing that it wasn't what we thought it was. Mm-hmm. and so we're experimenting. And out of experimenting, you learn just as much from your failures as you do from your successes, maybe mm-hmm. even more. Mm-hmm. But donors don't want to have to explain that their money went to a failure.
Yeah.
There's a real conflict there because you have to let things happen and learn from those instead of trying to control everything. So I guess that's what my major message would be.
Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we hit the button?
I don't think so. I think that about covers it. Yeah.
I hope we can get you to SAIS to talk to our students someday.